Hello and welcome back. I'm Dandy Zhu and you're listening to Digital Health Forward, a podcast dedicated to sharing the stories of healthcare entrepreneurs, leaders, and executives who are moving the digital health industry forward. Today, I had a chance to chat with Paxton Mader-York, CEO and founder of Alife Health. Alife Health's mission is to improve the efficacy and affordability of in vitro fertilization, IVF, through artificial intelligence. Founded in 2020, Alife recently raised a $9.5 million seed round led by Lux Capital. In this episode, Paxton and I chat about trends and innovation in the fertility industry, the data and technology Alife is building to improve access, affordability, and outcomes, the regulatory environment for AI algorithms in healthcare, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Paxton. Happy Friday. Welcome to the show.
Happy Friday, Dandy. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so excited to have you. And we haven't shared any stories on fertility topics yet, so I'm really excited to talk to our listeners more about this. But before we dive into what's going on at Alife, would love to start with hearing a bit about yourself, your background, your personal story, what led you to healthcare, what led you to starting Alife?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is I've been super passionate about the intersection of technology and medicine, basically as long as I can remember, back from doing robotics camps at MIT and working and following, watching surgeries at MGH and Brigham. I grew up here actually in the Boston area in Cambridge. And that passion followed through into a college where I studied biomedical engineering undergrad here at Harvard and continue to be really passionate about this space. After graduation, I worked at a company called Auris Health. Then it was just, you know, about 20 people. I was one of the early engineers there and then ultimately the first product manager and started up the clinical engineering group. But that company was building an array of different surgical robotic platforms with really a focus on lung cancer robotics, early lung cancer detection and treatment. I lost a few grandparents to lung cancer, so it was a mission that was really near and dear to my heart. That company ultimately ended up getting acquired by Johnson & Johnson for just shy of $3.5 billion. And so I came back and did a MBA at Harvard, as well as a master's in data science, increasingly becoming passionate and enthralled with the emerging opportunities for artificial intelligence or machine learning to help improve clinical practice today. It was through that kind of exploration that I bumped into this problem of embryo ranking. And I actually have a younger brother who's an IVF baby. I have a number of family members who have successfully used IVF. And so it was just an immediate resonance for me beyond my personal experience with it, the fact that it, you know, supports working people, having families later on in life, as well as the LGBTQ plus communities. It's such an impactful area of medicine and increasingly pertinent as we see the headlines around rising infertility rates. So completely fell in love with the problem, you know, started the company in 2020, and it's really just been an amazing ride ever since.
Yeah, excited to learn more. To help our listeners orient a bit more on the space, could we just start with the very basics of what exactly is IVF? How does it work? And you mentioned embryo ranking. What does that mean? And what is the mission of Alife within that context?
Sure. So infertility as a broad category is a massive problem globally. Hundreds of millions of people suffer from it. About 12% of couples run into infertility problems as they try to start a family. So it's a very widespread and under-discussed area of medicine. In vitro fertilization, which is abbreviated to IVF, is a methodology by which clinical practice can pull out the genetic material, both the mother and the male factor genetic material, and combine them in essentially a petri dish, culture that embryo for 5 to 6 days, and then retransfer it back into the carrying mother. And so it's a process that can oftentimes create an opportunity for childbearing where there previously may not have been one. So I got really fascinated by how this technology works, obviously its impacts. And, you know, one of the critical steps, there are many critical steps, and Alife overall is working to optimize each one of those steps of the IVF process. But one of the really important ones is helping to select or rank the embryos and prioritize which one to transfer first over to the mother. And so, you know, by improving that prioritization and helping to choose the first one to transfer more accurately, the goal would be to reduce the number of cycles. On average today, it takes 3 IVF cycles to have a successful pregnancy, successful outcome rather, and cost about $60,000 all in total per successful outcome. So anything we can do to reduce that burden and get it right earlier on is obviously reducing cost, improving access, and helping patients. So that's really where A-Life was founded is, hey, how can we use modern pattern recognition enhanced by computers, which is really all machine learning is, to improve that process. And our goal is to improve the equity and efficacy of IVF.
Do you think the IVF technology is the underlying technology itself in clinical practice? Like, how has that shifted or changed or gotten better over time? Do you feel like more people are using IVF and becoming more educated or comfortable with the idea of using it?
Absolutely. IVF has been a technology that actually originally came from kind of the zoology or husbandry areas and then became adapted about 40, 50 years ago towards the human population. So much of what we practice today actually is a carryover, which is mind-blowing for a number of reasons. But yes, all the trends we're seeing is a radical growth in the utilization of these types of techniques. We see about 10% a year-over-year growth in the number of cycles annually in the United States. We also see, massive growth in things like egg freezing or preventative measures taken by young people to try to get ahead of the curve on infertility should it arise later on in life.
It's great that there's that trend. And, it sounds like this is something that is very important and, to your point, is not talked about that much. But the fact that so many people and 1 in 8 couples are having trouble with fertility issues and getting pregnant, hopefully the fact that we're seeing more investment in this area, growth in the market, it's hopefully all leading to better outcomes. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the landscape. There's so many different players ranging from egg freezing, like you mentioned, to pregnancy and motherhood and sexual health and chronic care. And just the list is endless when it comes to this broader category of what we call, I guess, women's health. Where do you see A-Life playing in this ecosystem in the near term? And how do you see that evolving over time?
So I think there are a lot of different people coming and entrepreneurs coming at this problem from different angles. I think, to your point, awareness is a number one thing that we want to work on as a society. And I think the trends are generally in the right direction there. What we really focus on is improving the clinical efficacy. So, there's a lot of different companies coming at it from either a provider side or more of a light touch through, ovulation tracking or other things like that. Mm-hmm. We're medical device specialists. Our expertise is in hardcore, complex medical device systems and applying cutting edge technology to clinical practice. And so that positions us in a pretty unique spot to build technology, integrate with the current protocols and care that's being delivered today, and actually improve to the best of our abilities the outcomes for patients going through the process. What that also means is that we have really unique data that we're able to collect through partnerships, through utilization of our products. And so that allows us to have a really, really specialized insight into the type of care that's being delivered and how we might be able to improve it. One of the things that's really important to us is improving the access of this type of treatment for a larger variety of different types of demographics. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, surprisingly enough, females were not well represented in historical medical science within the fertility sector and are just starting to become more represented. And minorities, of course, were even less represented. And so one of the things we're really proud of is we've built this massive data set through collaboration with the largest clinics in the United States that's incredibly representative demographically and of the patient population. And so we're finding new insights that really have never been studied before. To your other question of where do we end up and how do we want to progress as a company, our goal first and foremost is to improve the experience of the patient. They are our first, second, third, and last customer here. And so over time, we hope to evolve to really improve that experience that an IVF patient goes through, creating a one-stop shop or overarching technology suite to help them access and assess their care pathways as best as possible. So that's kind of the direction that we're headed with the company and through really, strong design principles and thoughtful patient experience study, we're able to build this type of technology that really integrates all the relevant stakeholders together and provide a much needed improved transparency and empowerment to the end patient.
I'd love to learn more about the technology itself. And you mentioned the big data set that you guys are starting to build with partnerships. Can you share a little bit more detail into what kind of data is most relevant here and what sorts of tools you're thinking of building on top of that?
All the different data that we collect are pretty much as much variety and as many different aspects to an IVF cycle as we can get. So our data set has massive amounts of diversity and really is everything from step one of the process and the medications that a patient's on through to the end result. Relative to some of the specific products like the embryo ranking algorithm, for example, we've really worked hard to build a large data set. And I think it's fair to say we've one of the largest in the country of images of embryos, which is very difficult to get to. And so, you know, one of the problems we immediately identified was we'd love to be able to build this algorithm, and we've done an amazing job of building a huge data set that really backs and supports the algorithmic development. But we also realized very quickly that this type of data is super unstructured today. And so one of the nice things we've built into our product is not just the output of our algorithm, but also a whole suite of software to help clinics take and store and catalog and structure their image data so that we can continue to build these types of tools down the line to ultimately help patients. So it's really all of the above, and those pieces of data, you know, then are all tied together and ran through a series of convolutional neural nets and artificial intelligence algorithms in order to provide what we think and they're showing is a very useful metric and output to the clinicians.
In practice, how do you go about creating this data set and getting access to all of this, all these images, you know, in these partnerships? What are these clinics getting in return, or how does that conversation happen?
So the early conversations, and this is, you know, relevant to anyone starting an artificial intelligence based medical company, you know, we're of course difficult. We're very lucky to get put in touch with some fantastic early clinical partners who happen to be the largest in the country. And so in turn for their, you know, kind of initial support, we offered them a little piece of equity in the company in return for their data. Mm. Now we've gotten to the point where we are fairly unique within the US market with not really any other incumbents or competition nearby to where we stand. And so now a lot of our clinical partners are just really excited to work with us and are providing data access in return for, you know, early usage of our product. So that conversation has certainly evolved, but you know, data is at the root of everything we do here. And the way I describe it to our clinics is that we're really just trying to start the engine. We're trying to get, you know, an initial algorithm that is viable and usable and provides true clinical utility to the clinicians and to the patients. But once we have the products in market, exactly what I was discussing with you, we're collecting massive amounts of new data through its usage. And so our algorithms will continue to reinforce themselves and get better over time as you know, more clinics are now structuring their data and saving their data in a format that's going to be applicable to this type of technology development.
Right. Makes sense. So it sounds like the providers are the main user of the platform. Is that right?
Yes. So it's a little bit of a B2B2C channel where the clinics actually utilize the tools, but the patient's getting the end benefit. And we also do a lot to try to read out the results in a way that the patients can now digest them and understand what quality of their embryos are so they can make the best decisions about their own care as well in conjunction with their clinicians.
Yeah. And when it comes to the business model in mind, when you say B2B2C, is it providers that would be paying to have access to this platform, or payers, or another party?
So because infertility and IVF in general is about 75% out-of-pocket pay, most of this will be sold to the clinic and then the clinic will sell it to the patient. So this will be an add-on feature to a patient's current IVF cycle. There are many precedents for this, including pre-implantation genetic testing or screening of the like, where it's an additional charge. And so that's really the start business model. I will say, you know, I believe so much in this technology, and I think it really is so impactful to every clinic that over time I expect it to end up just being standard of care and that cost to be baked into the foundational basic, you know, service price that a clinic charges a patient for an IVF cycle.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that would be amazing for it to be a part of standard of care. Wanted to talk a little bit about some of the access issues that this technology will hopefully solve. But you mentioned health equity gaps and also improving access for LGBTQ plus communities. Can you just speak a little bit more about how that will happen? You know, what do we expect to happen with this technology being commercialized for IVF?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the biggest problems in IVF today is that we don't have a great understanding of how different populations react to the medications or how to tailor their treatment directly. And so we see outcomes data that are difficult. And, you know, and then of course there's the cost. And so when I think about how we are working to improve access, foundationally, it's about building tools that analyze and pull out insights that are directly relevant to minorities, like that have never been able to be done historically through traditional research, because those types of demographics, the data just doesn't quite exist well in any of the public data sets. And then two is reducing that cost as much as we can through the compounding effects of our products, not just embryo ranking, but the other pieces to reduce that price and that burden on the end patient. Mm-hmm. And so it's more accessible for more different groups and demographics.
In your ideal world, what would a patient journey look like when it comes to IVF and how they experience it?
Great question. Without alluding too much to our product roadmap, yeah, I think for me, whenever I talk to an IVF patient, there's this sense of confusion and unfortunately a little bit of desperation in terms of finding the answers to the critical questions and having to navigate this process. I think some areas that are really interesting to look at are like mental health support. You know, clinicians are fantastic, but and you'll see a lot of the modern clinics are starting to do this and pair the clinical treatment with mental health support and therapy on the side. But I think that what patients, I hope in the future, get is a very clear set of tools that can help them understand what their options are, understand their specific case can be best handled, whether that's by clinic or by clinician, and then empowerment and transparency throughout the process. So they understand at every point, you know, exactly what's happening to them, exactly where what their options are, and really creating a platform that connects each patient to each other and to specialists so that throughout that process, which can take months, they have a lot of resources and support and they don't feel like they're really on their own. So that's from a patient experience side. And then on the other side, you know, as a someone who uses healthcare, I would want, you know, the optimal health treatment pathways to be built for me as an individual, a personalized care pathway for my treatment. And that's really what AI and machine learning can offer. You know, what's so amazing about this technology is that it can digest, you know, hundreds of thousands of patient cases, historical patient cases, and find new patterns and correlations. And so it can suggest and find treatment and make, you know, actual care pathways that are really tailored to the individual patient it's seeing. And I think that's something that we all want. We are all individuals, we're all unique, and we want our treatment to be tailored to our unique situation. And I think that's kind of the promise that these types of tools can hopefully deliver.
I'm curious, I'm sure you've gotten a range of reactions from different providers, some who may be more skeptical than others, but what are some of the biggest concerns that providers have when it comes to adopting tools like this? Is there, you know, mistrust of algorithms still? Do you feel like people are open to it? People are, you know, resistant? What has the reaction been when you talk to, you know, different clinicians on actually incorporating this into their workflows?
The reaction has been overwhelmingly positive, I have to say. I think this is an area of medicine, infertility specifically, where there's been a lot of excitement around artificial intelligence, but very few people actually developing them into real tools. And so, you know, most of the patient conversations and the clinician conversations are all, hey, we see the value here. This seems like a great technology. We want to use it. The two major areas of concern that I think are probably fairly straightforward to guess are, one, how is this going to fit into my current clinical protocol? You know, is this going to add 50 steps, or is this going to be a really easy to use software? And that's something that we do very well at A-Life. We've got a lot of experience building complex systems, but making them incredibly easy to use for the clinician and fit perfectly within their current protocols, integrate with all the systems that they need to integrate with. So I think that's a pretty large differentiator for us as a company. And then the second area is, as much excitement as there is for this technology and kind of the almost no-brainer nature of this type of development, there's still always, you know, can you show us that this is really going to improve outcomes? And I think that is a fantastic question for people to be asking, especially in an area where historically, unfortunately, there's been a lot of technology that's come in claiming to be the silver bullet and hasn't really delivered against it. And frankly, in a lot of areas of medicine, there is no silver bullet. And so the approach that ALife has taken is we're not going to claim that we're, you know, going to give a 30% or a massive improvement that's really impossible to do. What we are going to do is optimize and tailor the treatment at every step so you get a compounding effect that is incredibly meaningful. And so we're really doing everything we can, and I think are really in a league of our own in terms of the clinical study, the rigorousness of our data science team, our publications. We've got 4 abstracts at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine coming up in October. We're giving a talk there. We work really hard to build the conviction and the trust of the clinical community so that they can then go to their patients and say, we've seen the data, this is real, this is going to provide value to you and is worth the extra cost. So those are really the two main things, both of which I think are incredibly foreseeable and also thankfully play to the strengths of the business.
And what is the current state in terms of how regulatory bodies view this technology? Are there any regulations yet on algorithms like this that require, you know, say FDA review, or are you guys not quite in that realm yet as like a medical device categorization?
So we definitely are. The guidelines basically say that any technology dealing with medical imaging needs to be FDA regulated. So we've already had multiple conversations with the FDA. We are following their guidelines. We are working towards a 510K and getting regulatory clearance for our flagship product. Some of the other products fit into a variety of different regulatory levels. You know, things that are really focused on the patient experience are not regulated. Some things kind of fall into a middle ground. But the FDA has done a nice job of regulating and also giving good guidance as to how to, you know, really show them that what we built is worthy of clearance. And it's been great to work with the regulators throughout this process.
It's so interesting because the process to review a medical device that, you know, then goes out on market and, you know, maybe you're monitoring adverse events or something, but that's so different from a much more iterative, fast-paced software development cycle where you're probably, you know, releasing changes on algorithms and things on a much more frequent basis, right? So how does the FDA think about, you know, after they approve it for the first time, how they will monitor it? What happens if you guys have changes or new releases?
The current guidelines and the ones we're fitting into is for a static algorithm. So an algorithm that we've trained, it is, you know, the weights are frozen and we put it through regulatory process. If we adjusted that in a significant way, it'd either be letter to file or we'd have to redo some tests. And I think that's totally appropriate. You know, this is a new area for the FDA. Algorithms like these are fresh and they're still figuring out exactly how to regulate them. And it's not straightforward and it's not easy. I think over time, what we can expect and hope for is that the FDA will transition a little bit away from the historic kind of using tests as the best metric for the safety and efficacy of a product towards actually looking at the development and the training, because algorithms are very difficult to test all the corner cases. But you can look at the practices that were taken and during the actual development of the algorithm, looking for bias and looking at the diversity of your data set and things like that, and really get a good perspective on the quality of that type of algorithm. So, you know, it's early days and we're working with the FDA, and I think that their position and their strategy is going to evolve over time. But I think to their credit, they're engaging with us and are helping to figure out and develop their own, you know, kind of personas as they want to decide how to regulate these types of technologies.
Right. I think someone once explained it to me as almost like a TSA pre-check framework where as a business, you're essentially evaluated on the practices, the quality processes, those types of things in place rather than, to your point, individual tests and releases. But I think it's so interesting to see them react to all the innovation happening in digital health and see how they can create a framework that's actually scalable.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's going to take time for sure. And, you know, I think the safety of patients and of course mothers and future parents and the like is obviously at the forefront of their mind. So we empathize with them and we're excited to be partners with them as this new area kind of develops.
Yeah, definitely. Great. Well, wanted to shift gears a little bit to some parting reflections. Saw the recent $9.5 million seed round, which is amazing. Congratulations. So with that, we talked a little bit about some of the in-flight priorities, but what are some of the near term goals for this year and in the near term?
So we're very thankful to have the support of an incredibly strong, deep-pocketed, and most importantly, diverse cap table. You know, we care a lot about having a lot of different backgrounds and demographics on in the company, on the leadership team, on the board, and of course, as investors. So we've worked really hard to do that. You know, that money is helping our development. We've actually finished the development of our first product, the Embryo Ranking System, and are now working to put it into pilot sites and do the clinical studies to pass FDA. We've got a second and third product under development right now and are very excited with how those are continuing to emerge. And we've got a lot on the long-term horizon in terms of additional products and partnerships and the like. So, you know, this money helps us operate, it helps us attract wonderful talent, and it helps us deliver against those core mission principles of proving the equity and efficacy of IVF.
Well, we're excited to follow the journey and best of luck. I wanted to end on some parting words of advice you might have for other entrepreneurs, other young professionals, MBA students who are also interested in making a difference in healthcare. Maybe reflections on if you ever thought you would be an entrepreneur and starting your own company, how that journey has been, if it's been different at all from what you expected, and any other insights to share.
Yeah, so a lot of the advice that I would share really comes around the problem. I think a lot of early entrepreneurs may have an itch to start something, but aren't quite sure what to start or whether or not what they're working on is the right thing to start a business around. I would have two pieces of advice for them. First, pick a problem that you really deeply care about, something that's important to you, that resonates with you, that you could build a full mission around, that you think other people will be excited around. It just, when you're building something like this, there's always going to be highs and lows. And having something that you're truly dedicated to, you understand the benefit to others, and you're really, really, you know, invested in, I think can help you weather that storm. And also, you know, make the highs even higher. The second piece of advice I would have is pick a really big problem. Go out there and find something that, not to exaggerate, but is literally a humanity scale problem. Something that you think is going to affect as many people as you can. You know, I think that's important for two reasons. One, just for the kind of mechanical reasons of, you know, you want to have a large addressable market and you want to have something that's really impactful. But, you know, I think from a societal standpoint, those are the problems where we need a ton of help with. And we want the best and brightest to go work on those types of problems. So that would be my recommendation. Pick something you're really passionate about and you care about, you know, whether you have a personal relationship to that problem or not. I think it's got to be something that you're ready to spend 10 years trying to improve. And two, pick something that's a very large problem that you could see it's impacting a huge swath of the population, where it's something that is really important in the individual lives of those it affects.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for taking time the last half an hour or so to share your story and A-Life story. I think we're all very excited to see how innovation progresses in this field. And, you know, one day, who knows who listening to this might be the recipient of the technology you're building. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Dandy. Pleasure to be here.